Let me just say that I'm as pleased as Punch to say that I'm as pleased as Punch to say that here comes the Colonel.
Yes, yes, yes. It never ends, does it? We share the building with some other studios, and auditions for Comedy Central go on down the hall, and they sneak in here once in a while to disrupt a serious science program. Yes, well, welcome back. The second half hour of The Promise of Tomorrow here on the Science News Radio Network. I'm your host. I'm Colonel Mason. So glad to have you back. We're going to hear from a friend of mine in just a minute, Jim Poland. Happened to be sitting around with him over coffee and scotch, and found out that that he knew Rick Smalley back in the old days, before Rick won the Nobel Prize for discovering the Buckminster Fullerene in 1985. And then we found out that Donna Nelson, Donna Nelson from OU, Oklahoma University, has been advising the television show Breaking Bad. She's been the science advisor on there. She's got to come on here and tell us all about that. Right now, though, let's jump over to our fountain of useless information and for today's query. Get around this coin jar.
Welcome to the fountain of useless information. How can I help you?
Okay, I see we've thrown in the coins and have aroused the old spirit of the fountain, who knows all, hears all, sees all, and tells all for a price. All right, old spirit of the fountain, put on your geography thinking cap here for just a minute. Which country would you run smack into if you sailed due east from the mouth of the Thames? Sailing due east from the mouth of the Thames, what country would you run smack into?
I have given you my answer, and now you may tell me.
Aha! Cannot fool the spirit of the fountain. The country that you'd run right into if you sailed due east from the mouth of the Thames River? If you said France, you're wrong. Little tricky there. It's the Netherlands. That's where you'd hit. Okay, I'm back with our show. Okay, the Science News Studio Band taking us up to where I sat down with my old friend, Dr. Jim Poland, who remembers Rick Smalley from Rice University back in the 1970s. Well, here we are sitting around. We were going to have a scotch, but Jim decided instead he wanted to have coffee. And I'm with my dear friend Jim Poland, and we got on the subject of Rick Smalley. Jim knew Rick pretty well. And I said, well, let's turn the recorder on and see if we can't save some of this stuff for posterity. So what do you say, Jim? Tell me, now, where did you first meet Rick, and how did you know him?
Well, my first meeting with Rick was in about 1977. I did not know him very well, and he's only an incidental character in some of the stories I might be able to tell you. Rick Smalley. The actual building of this cell, the design of the cell, was a very secondary thing. Mostly, Rick came to the machine shop to flirt. He would talk with my wife, which I was just young enough to be a little bit jealous. And to my pleasure, my wife said, he may be a good chemist, but he doesn't know any thermodynamics whatsoever. My wife, remember, was the thermodynamicist. Rick was an exceptionally good chemist, very glib, always seemed to have ideas. When I had met him, he had this enormous high crown, dark hair around the fringes, a tall fellow, I remember that. But I got the feeling that he just came around to drink the coffee and chat and maybe recruit some student helpers, because some of the chemical engineers hankered to also be in the chemistry department, and vice versa, I may add. And that just about is the end of the story. I saw Professor Smalley from time to time on the campus. Occasionally at social functions. I can't say that I remember anything distinctive. I do recall that he had ideas. He was eager to describe some of the things that he was doing, but a lot of it went over my head, and when he went into areas that I did know about, he had the gift of gab, but I'm afraid his knowledge base was lacking in those areas. This is not to detract from the man at all. He was very much a generalist, but if he wasn't sticking to spectroscopy and practical aspects of chemistry, he and I didn't have much in common. And I was very protective of my wife. And not that he was in any way inappropriate. His behavior was certainly appropriate and certainly gentlemanly. But he had an eye for the ladies, and he did it with everyone around him, regardless of age, nationality, or area of specialization. He was very much the ladies' man. Colonel, that's about all I remember about Rick.
All right, Jim. Well, this was in 1977. I guess Rick would have been 36, 37 years old at that time, and that was well before the discovery of the Buckminster Fullerene in 85. And, of course, he was hanging around with Bob Curl, and you talked about spectroscopy. Of course, that's Curl's specialty. But Rick was the lady. Is this your current wife? Is this Carol you're talking about?
No. Another person.
Well, you have a beautiful eye for women on your own self, so I'm sure that that particular wife at that time was certainly ravishingly beautiful, and I have no doubt that Rick probably was taken with her. He had a kind of a reputation, and it's said that women loved him. Did you get that impression?
I got the impression that women were very often nothing but patient with him. You can read into there what you want.
Because he would hit on the women a lot, and so you saw that he would be patient with them in the different situations. Or help me understand a little more.
It's difficult to distinguish the borderline between being a flirt and being a ladies' man. He was politely flirtatious. I don't mean to imply in any way that he was inappropriate or anything else, but he certainly could make conversation with the ladies, and he got very quickly bored when he was talking to any male colleagues.
Particularly fascinated with the women. Well, that's interesting. And, of course, he had several marriages of his own, and one in particular, of course, is the everlasting talk of people that know him and those that wanted to know him, and that's the exotic dancer that he fathered a child by. When did you hear about that?
I didn't know anything about that. This is news to me. My next knowledge of Professor Smalley was after he won the Nobel Prize in, what was that, the late 80s, early 90s, something of that sort. At that point in time, I read up just a little bit about his career and kind of raised my eyebrows that I had met the man and had a little bit of interaction with him, but I knew nothing about his personal life whatsoever.
Well, of course, he led the team that discovered the carbon-60, Buckminster Fullerene, in 1985, and that was the team was Bob Curl and, of course, Harry Croteau, who's now at Florida State University. And then two students, one a very good friend of mine, Sean O'Brien, who's currently now with Texas Instruments, and then Jim Heath, who's was with Caltech until recently. He's now with UCLA. And Heath, you know, both those students are doing some really remarkable things on their own. But the Nobel Prize, if I remember correctly, I'll have to check my notes, I think it was 96. I think that's how long it was. And I remember his family telling me about how every year they thought that he might get the Nobel Prize. And so he'd go away on little vacations simply because he didn't want to jinx it. So he was out of town when he and Bob and Harry discovered that they shared the Nobel Prize for carbon-60. Of course, getting an insight to his personality is really a very helpful thing. All the way back to 1977. When did you part company with Rick? I didn't see him anymore.
Probably 78, 79. I made a few trips back to Rice University, gave a few seminars of my own. I don't recall whether or not he was in attendance at the time. After I finished my work for Riki Kobayashi, after that work was published, I think I was invited back to give a few talks on it. I gave it a theoretical bend so that it was more chemistry, more thermodynamics than it was engineering, per se. So it had a wider audience appeal. I simply don't recall if Smalley attended those seminars.
Okay, so we leave Dr. Poland and his remembrances of Rick Smalley at Rice University in years gone by and check in with Donna Nelson, the Chemist of the Year in Oklahoma, professor at OU, Oklahoma University. And we caught up with her at the American Chemical Society Conference. She was the science advisor for the television show Breaking Bad.
Right now I'm at the ACS meeting in Indianapolis, but what I've been doing with Breaking Bad is just being a science advisor for the last few years. And I would work by email, you know. So if they had a question on their script or if they had a question about how something was pronounced or whatever, they would email me or send me a few script pages or whatever, and I would just answer their questions.
Well, that's good. I want to hear more about that. But right now, you're not in California. You're in Minneapolis. Is that what you said, Minneapolis? And why are you there?
I'm in Indianapolis.
Indianapolis. All right, not to get it confused with Minneapolis. What are you doing in Indy?
There's an American Chemical Society national meeting here this week.
Well, that explains everything. Of course, you're going to be there. You're what, voted Chemist of the Year? Is that right?
Well, that's the Oklahoma Chemist of the Year for that one state. Yes, I was. Isn't that wonderful?
How come you never tell me these things? You know, nobody tips me off to this stuff. Our friend Tom Levesque. Nobody says, "Hey, Colonel, you got to do a story with, you know, Donna. She's voted Chemist of the Year."
Well, I don't know. I've just been really, really busy.
Well, obviously, you've been really busy. I haven't been able to speak with you for a while. I'm going to try to set up this interview, and then you had to do it on the road and had to arrange time there at your hotel room. So bring us up to date about what's going on at OU and what you're doing in chemistry there, and then let's talk about this Breaking Bad thing.
Well, of course, I'm still on the faculty at OU, you know, as I have been for a long time, and I teach organic chemistry, mm-hmm. and I do research. I functionalize single-walled carbon nanotubes, mm-hmm. and I analyze the functionalized SWENTs by using NMR, and although a lot of people were skeptical at the beginning, we persisted, and we were successful with that, and I've been very delighted about that, and we've gotten a lot of publications, you know, because whenever people add single-walled carbon nanotubes to polymers in order to make the polymers stronger, they never did really understand exactly how the polymers interacted with the single-walled carbon nanotubes. They didn't understand how the functionalities in the polymers interacted. And as a matter of fact, which functionalities interacted more strongly. And so what we did is we took different functionalized monomers, you know, the smaller compounds, mm-hmm. and we would add them to the single-walled carbon nanotubes, and we would take an NMR before we added the SWENTs and then after we added the SWENTs, and we could look at the chemical shifts of the protons to see which ones were moved the most, and the ones that were moved the most indicated which portions of the molecule were interacting most strongly.
Well, and you said you had a lot of people that were very skeptical about this because they didn't understand nanotechnology. Was that the problem?
Well, no, they thought that the NMR shifts, the NMR signals, would be broadened way too much, and so we wouldn't get anything except just a bunch of, you know, really broad hills in there. But it turned out we were able to get nice sharp signals, and so then we were able to indeed differentiate the reactants from the products. And so it all worked out great. And so we've been publishing that. You know, we would publish the complexes of the SWENTs with amines and the SWENTs with amides, mm-hmm. and then that was separately from the SWENTs with the carbonyls, et cetera, et cetera. And so we just, you know, have been publishing these papers that detailed the interactions between SWENTs and one particular functional group, and we've been just doing a series of that, and we've been very, very happy with that.
Well, you're an old hand at nanotechnology. I mean, you've been working in nanotechnology since I first met you, and that was years ago. So you're one of the experts in the field.
Well, on NMR, using NMR to analyze functional life events. I guess you could say that. That's true. Thank you very much. That's a very nice thing of you to say.
Well, you had so many nice things to say about reading my press releases. I put people on the list, and then I forget who all gets them. And you, poor girl, you've been getting probably everything in the world, whether you're interested in having it or not.
Oh, no, I was interested. I'm interested. I think it's a nice service to everybody in the region. It. I really have. There have been things going on in Oklahoma I did not know about. I would not have known about if I hadn't read it in your press release.
Aren't you incredible? What a nice thing for you to say, Donna. Gee whiz. Now I gotta know where I need to send the money, you know?
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you so much. What a great thing to say. Now, how did it happen the producers of Breaking Bad get a hold of you to be an advisor for their production?
Well, what I did is, as I mentioned, I'm a member of the American Chemical Society, and the American Chemical Society has this trade magazine called Chemical and Engineering News, which mm-hmm. I know that you're familiar with.
Sure.
And they interviewed the producer, Vince Gilligan, back during season one.
Okay.
And this was about after maybe the fifth episode had aired. And as you know, we're always trying to think of ways to get chemistry and science in general out to the public. Mm-hmm. And so when I read this article in which Vince, the producer, said that they didn't have any funding to hire any science advisors or science writers, and neither he nor his writers had any formal background in science, but they would really appreciate constructive comments from a chemically inclined audience. That's exactly how, as he put it. And I thought, hey, here is a Hollywood producer reaching out to scientists, asking for help in getting the science right. He said that was very important to him, to get the science right. And I thought, this is wonderful. But then when I read the whole article, I realized, oh my gosh, this is about illicit meth production. And I thought, oh no, this is a horrible subject. You know, we've been waiting for this for a long time, but what a subject.
Mm-hmm.
And then I thought, well, I'm not going to just say no immediately, you know. I'm going to go away and watch some of the episodes, and I did. And when I saw what was happening to Walt, you know, the main character, the high school organic chemistry teacher,
mm-hmm.
He was getting dragged through the Arizona sand in his underwear and shot at and beat up, etc. And I thought, no child is going to watch this television show and say, yeah, that's the lifestyle I want, and then get lured into the drug scene.
Mm-hmm.
So I felt a lot better about it, and so I contacted Rudy Baum, the main editor for Chemical and Engineering News at that time, and I said, you know, this person, this Hollywood producer, has said he would like help from scientists so that he could get the science right, and just if you could communicate to him that I volunteer, and then if he's really serious about this, we'll know, because he'll get back in touch with me. And mm-hmm. guess what? He got back in touch with me.
Oh, that is a fascinating story, and I've got to tell you, I admire you for that. You know, they're going to make the movie, whether you know the film, whether you're going to contribute or not. But one of the things that is so annoying to me, and it may be annoying to you too, I don't know, but to watch a program on television or in the theater where they get everything wrong. I mean, you could watch maybe a legal show, and you know nobody can introduce that evidence in court without some sort of way of getting it in there. But Perry Mason used to do it all the time. And then you get to see these science shows or other shows that you know are so preposterous. I mean, some of the things that you see on TV, and you know, and they make it look like the science is real and it's happening and everything else. Well, some of the stuff they might be able to do, but they can't do it in 5 minutes like they do on television and pop up on a screen. It takes days. So for you to be able to do that is just absolutely incredible.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I know what you mean. I mean, some of it's total garbage. And when we scientists see that, it's like fingernails on the blackboard.
Mm-hmm.
You can just barely sit there. And so I was thinking that this would be a service to the scientific community and to scientists, and it would help Vince, and I would have a lot of fun. And I was right.
Well, absolutely. And then, of course, your name is going to be in the credits. And I have to admit, I'm not a television watcher, so I wouldn't have noticed your name in the credits. But had I noticed, I would have given you a call and say, hey, Donna, congrats. That's great.
Yeah, that's true. My name's in the credits. In those episodes where I assisted, my name is there. I have been so thrilled to be able to do this. Like I said, it's been a lot of fun, but it also makes me feel really good to see them put something scientific on the screen, something that I know I've assisted with, and watch it be completely correct, and know that any students who are watching that will see that it will agree exactly with what they're being taught in their classroom.
Oh, that's great. That feels really good. Well, I hope that the films will become more sophisticated. You know, I used to watch these films like North and South and others and think, you know, why can't they tell the truth? You know, the truth is a whole lot more exciting than trying to write these lies, because the truth of what happened is a fascinating story in itself.
Oh, it is, yeah. You know, it's just a little bit more difficult. Or sometimes I think, I've heard, not from Vince or anything, but I've heard that sometimes they're afraid that the scientists will be too heavy-handed and try to turn their show into a scientific education show. Mm-hmm. And so I was exactly the opposite. What I did is when they would send me a script, I had respect for their writers. I knew that the main goal was to get a show that was interesting. They had to have an interesting show. And so when I would go in to make any changes, I would change as few words as possible, just enough to get the science right, and I would still try to capture the cadence and the alliteration and mm-hmm. everything that they had used in their script, you know. And with their writers and I got along just fabulously.
Oh, that's great to hear, Don. I'm so excited for you, and I'm so glad you gave us a call and tipped us off to this, because I hadn't had a chance to talk to you in really quite some time. And so you're at the Chemistry Association's show in Indianapolis. Get it right this time. And what do you expect to find there?
Oh, well, they've got a whole lot of new nanoscience that's being reported here, and then chemical education. And of course, I'm really interested in that because I teach such large classes in organic chemistry. Mm-hmm. And then there's just, you know, a whole lot of fabulous things. They're always looking at, the science behind climate change and everything that you see really in the news, because chemistry's behind all of it.
I'm surprised you could get away, because I'm sure classes have started again for you at OU.
Oh, yeah, they have. Yeah, well, I have a teaching assistant, and sometimes he can take over, you know, once in a while.
Okay, that's handy. Well, Donna Nelson, head of chemistry at University of Oklahoma, OU in Norman, Oklahoma, is an old friend of ours. Thank you so much for being with us. This is really great. Enjoy your time in Indianapolis, if that is possible.
Thank you so much. It's a great honor to be on your show.
And at this time, I want to thank you very much for those of you who have contributed to this program. We depend on contributions from listeners like you for the existence of this show. We're totally science community supported. So those of you who have contributed, thank you very much. Those of you who wish to can do so at our website, promiseoftomorrow.biz. On the right-hand side of your screen, you'll see a little tab there for donations. Just click the donations, and we appreciate all your help.
And now, we make time for the Voice of Reason. Listener comments, ideas, and suggestions.
My main sort of barometer, if you will, is, you know, consistency. I think, especially from a leadership perspective, I think it's really important to be consistent with your approach. You know, maybe not necessarily predictable, but consistent. Firm and fair. I think that can apply to, for the most part, any industry, any relationship, anything, function in a family atmosphere and a business atmosphere. I think that's worked for me. And, you know, people on your team have to be able to depend on you, and, you know, obviously your family, same thing, and vice versa. My name is Michael Payne. I'm the CEO of VisLink Inc. and the group technology officer for VisLink, the VisLink group.
So you decide. Has this really been the Voice of Reason? Listener comments are welcome at 214-329-4949. And please tell us your name and where you're from.
You've been listening to The Promise of Tomorrow with Colonel Mason, the definitive program on emerging and nanotechnologies, now archived and streamed on the web at promiseoftomorrow.biz. Join us next week at the same time as we learn more about the promise of tomorrow.
I am waiting for you.